Richard Haynes is a longtime student of Wormus. I actually have known him a good part of my life. Went to school with him. And since about 1995, Richard sent me a tape in 1995, and it said David Hudson on it. I didn't have any idea who David Hudson was, and Richard suggested that I listen to it. I was doing other things, and so I put it on my shelf and kind of forgot about it. And then, a few weeks later, Richard called me and said, "Hey, what'd you think of the tape?" "Oh, Richard, I'm sorry, I haven't listened to it." So I put it over on a shelf near my stereo. And then a week later, Richard called me again and said, "What'd you think of the tape?" And I said, "Oh, Richard, I'm really sorry. I haven't listened to it. I'll listen to it right away." And Richard says, "It's about what happened to Jim." And Richard had heard the story about Jim and the whole of his experiences, and this tape, which was from David Hudson, was about something that Richard felt was similar. So, Richard, could you explain how you got acquainted with David Hudson and Ormus and all of that, and how it relates to Ayurveda?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Barry. I have been a student of spirituality, we could say, although it's kind of a buzzword. But since 1970, when I began meditating and doing yoga, and I was also, what inspired me to get into meditation and yoga is because I was very sick all my life, and I was always looking for a way to be healthier. And I explored all avenues, and that eventually led me to meditation, yoga, and then to Ayurveda in the mid-80s. And I, with everything that I tried, I continued to get a little healthier, and I always just followed my intuition. And when I heard somebody talking about this ethereal matter made from heavy elements or gold, I was immediately interested, because in Ayurveda, gold and mercury and the heavy metals are used as part of therapies in what's called Bhasma therapies, where they transmute the metals in some way that is totally mysterious to Western science. And so I eventually learned more about it, got the tape, which I sent to Barry, and I went to seminars on David Hudson, learned about Ormus, and kind of was very interested in it ever since I first heard about it.
How did you first become acquainted with the David Hudson stuff? Part of setting it up, or?
No, a friend of mine went to a seminar with him. He was giving seminars all around the country and told me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just did some exploration on my own after that, and then found other seminars and eventually went to some of his seminars.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the elements, that the heavy metal elements that converted? I've seen something about that in Texas.
The Bhasmas that they make in India?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Okay. Well, it sounds mysterious. What they do is they prepare these mixtures with specific herbs and heavy metals, and it's very, like I say, almost mysterious. They do these special ceremonies, and they say mantras, Sanskrit mantras, and they put them in these in these clay vessels, and then they build these huge fires and in a hole in the ground, and they just keep burning these fires, and the coals keep filling up this hole, and then they throw this clay pot with these herbs and the heavy metals in it, and then they bury it, and they say the temperature rises to like over 600 degrees. I don't know what it does, and they leave it there for a period of time, and then they, when it cools down, well, they dig it back up, break the clay vessel, and then that is, that's how they get Bosmas, is my understanding of it.
That sounds like some of the methods that Michael Burberry has discussed on the forums.
So that's my understanding of that aspect.
Uh-huh. Have you used these?
Actually, they're pretty much illegal in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Anything with heavy metal in it.
Oh, yeah.
I have used some Bosmas that were made with pearl some way, but I didn't get much of an effect out of that. It was supposed to be for increasing calcium, but they were very expensive. I'll just let you ask the questions.
Well, go ahead. Yes.
Well, what I was going to say is that what I've come to understand is that Ormus is a product of consciousness, a product of spiritual development, rather than a cause of spiritual development. And there's Ormus, or these ethereal elements in everything, in all the food that we eat, in the air that we breathe, in the water that we drink. And what attracts it is our consciousness, our intention and our attention, the quality of our attention and the purity of our intention.
Uh-huh.
And so, and that's at every stage of the deal. And that's why I believe that the ceremonies, the mantras, the length of time of that these Ayurvedic masters devoted their own consciousness, their own consciousness is imparted into these Bosmas.
Uh-huh.
And then it's purified with the fire and brought out and elevated. But it's their intention and their consciousness that is really primary, and then the Ormus and the quality of the Ormus is a result of that consciousness. And then it must be then taken, administered, and consumed with consciousness, with a state of consciousness that is capable of attracting and maintaining and holding those qualities that that was originally imparted into the Ormus.
Now, you're working with a number of Ayurvedic techniques and processes. Could you describe some of these other things that you're working with and maybe discuss a bit about how you think they might be related to Ormus, or we can discuss that?
Well, starting out very fundamentally with the breath.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there's a very powerful breath that I learned that was really the key to my returning to balance or getting healthy, being able to maintain a normal lifestyle after nearly dying from Crohn's disease. And that breath, I remember teaching it to Barry.
Mm-hmm.
And Barry, his experience was that this makes a a magnetic trap out of the throat, and it collects ormus from the air. And I that makes total sense to me.
Uh-huh.
Because I can be working with a client, teaching them how to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And I use a biofeedback that measures parasympathetic, sympathetic dominance. And what you're always trying to do in any healing situation is to make the parasympathetic more dominant, which is the healing aspect of the autonomic nervous system. And when I have them breathing, I'm having them breathing fully and deeply, and then I show them how to do this breath. And there's an immediate shift in their autonomic nervous system that increases the parasympathetic value.
How do you measure that?
By measuring heart rate variability.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And heart rate variability, I mean, there's, you look on the internet, there's like tons and tons and tons of very well-documented correlation between a high heart rate variability and parasympathetic dominance or healing of the body. In fact, there's a whole organization called HeartMath that focuses on all their therapies are simply focused on developing a high heart rate variability to support parasympathetic dominance.
So you have their HeartMath device to measure that? Is that?
Actually, I have something that's actually more sophisticated than what HeartMath uses.
Oh, wow.
That I can print out on the computer. It gives not only the variability, but it gives the heart rate. And so I can see a lot of different things that you can't see. I've used I sell the M-Wave, which is and I recommend it because it's easy, it's very simple to use, and
mm-hmm.
and anyone can do it. But there's even more sophisticated equipment out there that I don't have that can actually take a measurement of your heart rate for like 6 minutes and give you a complete risk analysis for disease. Just
mm-hmm.
on heart rate variability alone.
Wow.
Very effective.
Does your device also measure heart-brain coherence?
No, it doesn't. But what the research shows that when the heart rate variability increases,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
there's a predominance of alpha and theta brain waves. So there's more coherence between left and right and between front and back that's directly correlated to increased heart rate variability.
Thomas has been working on exploring this a bit in conjunction with HeartMath and other institutions. And he's taken people that have been given his trap water ormus and has measured a definite effect where they go into a more coherent state within a few minutes of ingesting his trap water. So I can totally see how this might work with trapping ormus out of the air, so to speak.
Yeah, and I would add to that another kind of almost confounding variable is the consciousness of this person, Tom, his expectations, his intention, and his attention to the person that he's administering it to.
Mm-hmm.
That has a huge impact.
Mm-hmm.
huge impact. Just what, whatever he, you know, that placebo effect, which is really what all healing is, simply placebo, because you can, and you can do like energy healing and create, and so it has a tremendous amount to do with the practitioner's attention, his intention, and his innocent innocence, and just being able to be open, to be that channel, to be that magnet for growth.
Now, do you use some other things as well to? Now, you taught me about things like oil pulling and where you drop oil on the forehead and other things.
Right. Yeah. Okay, well, so we could start with going back to David Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
When he started experimenting with this, he realized that it was really important for his digestive system to be working properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started discovering that using Essiac tea that was high in ormus, which probably just meant that it was grown with love and attention so that it attracted more ormus,
mm-hmm.
In ground that was so they discovered that Essiac tea,
mm-hmm.
That was high in ormus, which my guess is just means that it was grown in ground that was not polluted with chemicals and even thoughts and greed,
mm-hmm.
and that it was grown with love and attention, so it would have more ormus in it. They used that to cleanse themselves so that they could actually take in more ormus. And in fact, that they... For many years, his partner, Don Duke, made this Essiac tea that was high in ormus, and they found great, great benefit from taking that Essiac tea. Well, turns out there's an Ayurvedic preparation called Triphala, which has amalaki in it, which is a herb that cleanses the digestive tract and purifies the digestive tract.
Could you spell that Triphala, you said?
Yeah, it's Triphala, T-R-I-P-H-A-L-A. T-R-I-P-H-A-L-A.
Great.
And it's recognized in Ayurveda as one of the primary, what are called rasayanas, are herbs that you can take forever with no side effects, and they merely strengthen the immune system, strengthen the body's natural processes.
Hi, Dennis. Hi, buddy.
Okay, and so there's that, and then there's another preparation called Chyawanprash, which David Hudson actually tested. It was one of the things that he initially tested,
mm-hmm.
for high concentrations of ormus, and it actually had the highest concentration of anything that I believe that he tested initially. And that is a 5,000-year-old formula, a Ayurvedic formula, that also has this same herb in it, this amala,
mm-hmm.
Which is in Triphala, along with other herbs prepared in a special way with cow's ghee and honey and cooked in a way that makes this kind of this jam that is called the elixir of life, or nectar of immortality, is referred to in Ayurveda.
Mm-hmm. Cow's ghee is fermented milk.
Ghee is clarified butter.
I see. Uh huh.
And ghee is The interesting thing about ghee is that it's pure fat, and all of the nerve tissue in our body is fat. And so what it says that Ayurveda says that ghee and infused with herbs can take the herb directly to the nerve tissue much more quickly than going through the process without ghee because of the fat, the quality of the fat that the ghee has.
Oh, it's a carrier.
So it's a carrier, yes. It's a carrier. And then another really interesting thing about amala is Deepak Chopra recently endorsed a product called Zri. Has anybody heard of Zri? It's Zri.
I have not.
Well, it's a big, it's really big on the internet. You search Zri and you'll find all kinds of stuff. But it's a big multi-level marketing thing that Deepak Chopra endorsed. But basically, it's just amala in mixed with other fruit juices, and you take it, 2 or 3 ounces a day. But my guess is that it's really, really high in monoatomic elements. And then the other really wonderful, kind of positive thing about that is just the fact that Deepak Chopra endorses it will have people have more confidence that it'll work, so it'll work better.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Now, is the oil, the ability of oil,
yes,
as a carrier of nutrients?
Yes, and oil is used in Ayurveda. In fact, oil infused with herbs is the primary way of getting these herbs into the system. And we can say, okay, herbs are from plants. Plants have ormus, so there's got to be ormus in that. And so the ways that they get it into the body is by infusing the oil into the herbs, putting the herbs on the skin, in putting the herbs in the nostrils where the skin is very fine, and snorting the oil into the sinuses, and also implanting the oil in the rectum where it can be absorbed. It's like an enema, except that it's a nutrient enema. It's an enema that goes into the body. So all these were ways and are ways that are still used in Ayurveda to bring more consciousness into the body through these herbs.
What does oil pulling do? I've had problems with my teeth recently.
Uh-huh.
And I was having some tooth pain. I was taking colloidal silver for it, but it wasn't quite doing it. I did some oil pulling, I think twice, and the pain went away.
Yeah, oil pulling is...
What did you say you were doing, Barry?
Let Richard explain.
So oil pulling is an ancient Ayurvedic practice that has been around for thousands of years. And what you do is you take a mouthful, like a couple of tablespoons of sesame oil or sunflower oil, and you swoosh it around in your mouth for 15 minutes. And then you spit it out and you wash your mouth out really well. And what this oil does is it pulls out toxins through the tissues. And how it works, I don't know, but people have gotten over cancer, have cured tumors, just there's miraculous anecdotal stories on the web. If you just look up oil pulling, you'll be able to read about many, many of those. And that's a very, very common Ayurvedic practice.
I've also used oil where I've taken grapeseed oil and mixed it with sea salt to get the ormus out of the sea salt, and that seems to work even better.
Yeah. I would imagine, because oils are wonderful. They're just, you know, all kinds of oils are used in Ayurveda.
Mm-hmm.
And ghee, which is another oil.
What? Ghee?
Ghee.
Yeah.
Clarified butter.
Oh, yeah.
In order to get herbs into to ghee, Richard, by definition, you're going to have to heat the herbs. And I've never seen that process. I love ghee. I use it quite often, but I've never seen the process of combining herbs with it. How hot do you have to get it?
Pardon?
Well, how hot do you have to get the herbs? Because, you know, ghee is sold at room temperature.
Right. Okay, so how you do it, I mean, there's a real simple way you can do it in your home. You can just take, like, a pint jar, and you can fill it, like, 3/4 up with ghee, and then put the herbs in that ghee, and then seal the jar, and then put it in boiling water. And then as the ghee melts, then you take the jar out, you shake it up, and put it back in the boiling water, and you just cook the ghee like that in boiling water for like 6 to 8 hours, shaking it up every half hour, 45 minutes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you let it sit, and the essence of the herbs will be cooked into the ghee.
Wow.
That sounds like a pretty sweet way to do it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way. I do it all the time, and you can do it not with ghee. You can do it with oils. You know, you could do it with that grapeseed oil and the salt, and put other herbs in it. You know, yes, very, very good. And if you use herbalized oil for your oil pulling, it's even more powerful, they say. And so I imagine the herbs then would be picked for the type of imbalance that you were attempting to address with oil pulling.
Can you use essential oils with oil pulling?
No. I don't think I would use essential oils. I would use herbalized, just different herbs.
I mean, let's say put an essential oil in with the oil you're using for the oil pulling, not
you probably could do that. Although I'd want to do some research on that. But yeah, because people take essential oils internally. So if the oil was chosen properly,
mm-hmm.
and you knew what you were doing, yeah, it would probably be a really good way to do that.
Now, you also have been working on and building an oil drip apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe it? What's that called?
It's called Shirodhara.
Mm-hmm.
Shiro means head in Sanskrit, and Dhara means flow. So what it means is the flow of oil onto the forehead. And the way it works is if you go to my website, ayurvedaplus.com, click on Shirodhara, there's a link to Deepak Chopra doing Shirodhara on Good Morning America or the Today Show or something. I can't remember which one it is. But anyway, you can see that. But what it does is you take this herbalized oil that we talked about, how you make, you infuse the oil with herbs that are specifically targeted to the imbalance that the person has, and then that oil is poured in a stream over the person's forehead as they're lying down. And it's poured on the third eye, and also it's used to stimulate various points on the forehead. And this calms the mind dramatically and also relaxes the body. It's much like a forced meditation. People say their mind stops thinking, they see visions, they feel the energy of different saints people have commented on. They feel their body turn translucent. Many, many different experiences, because what it does also is turn off the mind, which is a sympathetic nervous system, and it stimulates the parasympathetic dominant physiology. And in the Veda, in Ayurveda, it's said that Shiradhara alone, performed over a period of 21 days, will cure anybody of any disease.
Now, what do you think? You think that it's having like a placebo effect? I mean, not placebo, like you were saying before, where by calming the mind, by quieting the mind, the person doesn't maintain their illness anymore.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're saying, or?
Well, that when the body is left on its own without the interference of our mind,
mm-hmm.
which is our programming, our judgment, our frustration, our duty, you know, the drive to do something, when all of that is turned off, the body will naturally heal itself.
Wow.
The body always wants to go to homeostasis, to balance, to healing, to wholeness, to health.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only the mind that prevents that from happening.
So quieting the monkeys of the mind is one of the primary things that Shiradhara does.
Yes, and actually it's the primary focus of every healing modality in Ayurveda.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at everything that works, actually, that's what it does. And it does it in various different ways. You know, I mean, massage quiets the mind. Taking an herb quiets the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're doing, you know, you're saying to yourself, oh, this is going to help heal me. So there's a, and then if it actually also strengthens and there's some positive effect, then you get a feedback there. And then so you have even more confidence that it's going to work, and that relieves the mind. It calms the mind, just knowing that it's going to get better.
And what you mentioned several results. Any healing results that you've noticed with Shiradhara?
Oh, yes, dramatic. The most dramatic healing comes from people that have things like bipolar or schizophrenia, you know, or ADD. You know, diseases that are mostly in the mind. And in Ayurveda, that's called vata or prana-vata imbalance, a way overactive mind. And so in Western medicine, those are the most difficult conditions to treat. We really don't know how to treat them, because we treat them with therapy, with talk therapy, that just makes more thoughts. We treat them with herbs, and that just causes more, or drugs, and that causes more imbalance in the body and different feelings, and so it works for a while. And then, but in Ayurveda, it's very simple. We simply quiet the mind by using Shiradhara, and the benefits are really, really dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone comes in and they have a condition that just won't get better, I tell them, okay, if you really want to get better, let's do a series of 7 days of Shiradhara, and it always produces profound benefits.
Now, how long does the Shiradhara take?
From 20 minutes to an hour and a half. Uh-huh. You can do it up to an hour and a half, yeah.
And what makes you decide to do it one length of time versus another?
Well, sometimes we do a Shiradhara that follows a massage, so then we do a 20, 25-minute Shiradhara.
Uh-huh.
The person is already relaxed. If we're doing it specifically, just a Shiradhara by itself, and doing a series of them, we'll start out at 45 minutes and then work up, you know, 5 minutes a day until we get up to, you know, however long we're going to get. So you can go longer and longer as they get used to it and staying in that place longer.
And does almost everybody or everybody notice an effect from that?
Yes. Yes. I would say it's pretty universal that I've never had any. Well, once in a while, the first Shiradhara, a person will just, like, their mind won't let go. They just kind of fight it.
Mm-hmm.
But usually by the end, their mind is quiet. And then if they do it the next day, it works.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's very, very wonderful treatment.
What kind of oil do you use?
We use sesame oil.
Mm-hmm.
Infused with herbs or essential oils.
Mm-hmm. Is ghee an appropriate oil for that, or is that?
You can do Shiradharas with ghee, yes. And you can also do Shiradharas with buttermilk, with herbs in it, different things for different imbalances.
Mm-hmm.
Use different substances.
Do you still do asanas and yoga like that?
Yeah. I have a daily practice where I do some sort of asanas or pranayama. And again, the benefit there is consciousness. Connecting my attention, my loving attention to my body in a very loving, nurturing way. Many times yoga is misunderstood as kind of an exercise thing, but yoga in its essence was just a way to love the body, a way to love moving the body, a way to love stretching the body. It was not something that was at all strenuous or something that you had to try to do to get into some specific position or some specific posture. It was just a way to love the body and to connect with and nurture and appreciate and feel gratitude for your body.
Now, you're what, 60 years old? 60?
Yes.
And how has this affected the aging process for you?
Well, usually when people see me and they don't guess that I'm 60 years old.
Well, I certainly would.
Yeah, and I weigh about 130 pounds, and I can leg press 480 pounds.
Whoa!
That's what I work out with.
Uh-huh.
On my leg press. I do. I work out with weights once a week.
Oh, wow. And what about things like joint pain?
I have no joint pain. I have no pain in my body anywhere. And that's really saying something for me, because before I started doing all these healing practices, I was in pain almost constantly.
Mm-hmm.
From joint pain, pain from various old injuries, and then from Crohn's disease. Yeah.
Uh-huh. We're getting.
Eric, since a whole bunch of people are starting to come on now, probably from Australia, would you tell them about daylight saving time? Because I'm officially embarrassed.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It changed to daylight savings time Sunday in America.
So what Gary is just saying, for those people who have just come on, who might have just come on from Australia, is that I got tricked. They started daylight saving time in the U.S. without telling me. And so for those of us who are just coming on just recently, because I came on about 20 minutes ago and suddenly had an acute case of embarrassment, acute, we're going to make the recorded call available to you guys. So you won't miss out on anything. And so a guest, Richard, has been waving at some link without me, without us. And we've had this fascinating material just for the piece that I heard, which is basically this process of combining herbs with oil that takes the herbal essence immediately straight to the nervous system, which is basically, apparently, I didn't even understand this before, a fat-based system. I'm going, well, I didn't even know that nervous system was a fat-based system, which is quite an amazing technology. And
a fat-based system
has been
a fat-based
how to use this healing technique on Good Morning Australia or the Today Show in the U.S. And so that's pretty much where we're up to that I'm aware of. And so what else got covered in brief, Barry?
Well, Dennis, what did you say? A fact-based system?
What I heard was that the nervous system was a fact-based system. That wasn't my understanding, but I'm willing to be educated.
Yeah, nerve tissue is fatty tissue.
Oh, fat.
Yeah.
I heard fat.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Mm-hmm. So...
So would you quickly give an overview of what else has been discussed so far, so we know what to look forward to when we hear the when the recording?
Do you want to do that, Richard?
Okay. Well, we started out that I told the story of how I first found out about Ormus and kind of my personal kind of journey into that, into healing, and then into Ormus, and then into Ayurveda. Then we talked about the fact that what I believe from my experience and from reading the Veda is that Ormus is a result of consciousness, our spirituality, our spiritual growth, our experience. It's not a cause. It's a marker, but it's not a cause. That consciousness itself is primary, and we gave several anecdotal things to help to help convey that point.
Mm-hmm.
I could use this if you want to go into some other aspects of Ayurveda. Also we talked about Ayurvedic bhasmas, which are like they're medicines made with heavy metals, and how they're made, and how that is just obviously Ormus. technology.
Right. In fact, his description of the method for making them sounded a lot like a method that Michael Burberry has been talking about and others have talked about in the past. So, very cool. And you also mentioned oil pulling?
Yeah, the oil pulling. We talked about oil pulling as a way to help get toxins out of the body.
And then the oil dripping.
Yeah, we talked about that. Yeah, Shiradhara, yeah.
So would you briefly, quickly, succinctly, and with not so many words, explain the Shiradhara process, please?
Okay, Shiradhara, Shiro means head, Dhara means flow. And so what literally is happening is that a stream of oil is being poured on the third eye and on the forehead of the person receiving the Shiradhara. And it's warm, herbalized oil.
And the person's basically laying like on a massage table?
Yes, laying prone with their face up, their eyes covered, and the practitioner sits there and guides the stream of oil over their forehead. And the practitioner will also be using mantras or quieting their mind or meditating, and that flow of consciousness that will help to calm the person receiving the Shiradhara. Again, in Ayurveda, consciousness is primary, and so everything in Ayurveda is done with consciousness, with pure intention, and lots of attention.
Yeah, well, that pretty much goes for any decent consciousness healing practice. It's got to take attention and intention and shape and just the presence of the healer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, who makes the oil for that?
Bring us up to speed. Now, still people coming in Australia, and so thanks for that. And so, carry on before I interrupted.
and so you ask, Barry asked, who makes the oil? And I explained how you could make your own oil on this, and you just infuse the herbs into the oil and cook them in a water bath, and
mm-hmm.
and you know we talked about that on the.
Okay, so typically, do you make? When you do Shiradhara, do you do your own oil?
Yeah, we make our own oils here, yes.
Ah, I see, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Can you purchase them ready-made?
You can, yeah, and they're available on the website. Banyan has them.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty expensive because it is labor-intensive to make the oils.
Oh, and yeah.
You can certainly make your own, much if your time is, if you have enough time.
Yeah. Depends on whether you have more time or more money.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Are there some other processes and
yeah, what
techniques that...
Yeah, what I would like to talk about and share with everyone is the value of this consciousness 24/7. And the value of being aware, being present 24/7. So Ayurveda means the science of life. That's the literal translation. It's also been translated as the knowledge of life. But the translation that I think is the most accurate is that Ayurveda is the science of love. It's the science of how to really love someone. And love is what heals.
Mm-hmm.
And loving yourself is what will heal yourself. And love is simply consciousness itself. Consciousness flowing is love. Awareness flowing is love.
Amen. Loving yourself is very good. That's the most important thing. Yes, very good. I'll mute myself now. That's good. Thank you.
So Ayurveda was the science of how to love yourself. And so all of the recommendations, all of the knowledge in Ayurveda was simply how to live your life 24/7 so that you were loving yourself. And that's really the essence of it. And so then out of that comes the Ayurvedic routine, which the person would arise in the morning before the sun comes up. A person would eat in the middle of the day when the sun was at the highest point, because our fire inside is also at the highest point, and the fire is what digests our food. It's what actually can bring the ormus into the body, is our digestive fire. And then in the afternoon would be the time of the day to do mental activity and creative activity. And then the evening time was the time to rest and be with family and then to enjoy personal interaction. And then we always went to bed shortly after the sun went down in Ayurveda. In the West, it's called the 10 o'clock hour. And if you know what happens to you, if you are awake at 10 o'clock, you get what we call a second wind, and you have all this energy. But ideally, you would be asleep when that second wind happens, and all the energy that you experience it would be used to heal the body, to heal the nervous system, and to cleanse the body. And then you would arise early in the morning and then do that. And as you go through the day like that, with consciousness, with love, and with attention to that daily rhythm, then that attention was a carrier for the love of yourself. And during that day, the most important thing you do, besides breathe, to maintain the body, is to eat food. And food was sacred in Ayurveda. Food was God. In fact, the sutra is Anam Brahma. Food is God. And food, the physical food, becomes the physical body. So the quality of that food and the consciousness with which you consume that food directly affects the quality of your physical body and the quality of the consciousness that you express. So the kitchen was sacred. People were not allowed in the kitchen that weren't cooking. And the cooks were saying mantras, and they were putting their attention and their love into the food. And then the food then was eaten with gratitude and love and attention and a feeling of community that got instilled into the person. And this made for a strong family, a strong community, and a strong country. Very, very, very critical in Ayurveda. And in the West, I really believe that is why our society has deteriorated, because we tend to eat in fast food places. And I hope you don't think I'm being judgmental here, but I would say the highest percentages of cooks in fast food places are meth addicts. And it just, that's the energy that we put into our bodies. Instead, in Ayurveda, in the Vedic culture, the most important person in the household was the cook, the person that prepared the food, prepared the ormus. Alchemy was performed in the kitchen.
Wow.
So that, and they did it with consciousness, with love, and with the knowledge and the knowing that this was going to make their family strong, their community strong, and it was going to be the glue that held the family together.
There's been a lot of conversation recently on the various Ormus forums about the consciousness with which you prepare the Ormus. In fact, this is one of Dennis's primary messages. Isn't that right, Dennis?
Well, from my point of view, it is absolutely essential. And I learned this many, many years ago, that when someone prepares anything for you, they deposit a whole part of themselves in that gift. There's a really, really neat movie. If you guys have never seen this movie, you just got to see it. It's called Like Water to Chocolate.
Absolutely. I love that movie. Seen it many times.
Yeah. And the thing is, once you've seen it, you will see it again, because it's just so instructive of this basic process, this fundamental truth, that you cannot take something that comes from someone without taking the someone along with it.
Yes.
Here's an example. Sometimes if I go to a restaurant and I have access to the cook, I'll give him specific instructions. I'll say, would you please add the ingredient that is not on the menu, but is the most important ingredient in this dish? And some of them who, you know, just aren't clued in that very moment will say, well, what's that? And I'll say, your love.
Yes. Beautiful.
Your love for preparing food. Your love for being of service to people and with food. And, of course, the bright ones just light up straight away. And I remember I'm having this dish down a little town called Mullumbimby, which is about 25 minutes south of where I am. And guy comes out halfway through the meal, and he goes, well, did you taste the love? Mate, I was so consumed by this extraordinary meal, I could hardly speak to him, it was so delicious. Because when someone puts love into their food, it tastes vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I
have to love yourself first, too. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You have to love yourself. Learn how to love yourself first.
Well, you got to have
get
something
an email
to
give.
Oh, absolutely.
If you don't have anything to give, you know, not much blood you can put into a food unless you already got some.
Hey, it's time for a question from the free room. Anyone in the free room have any questions for Richard?
I've got a question here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm dealing with some heavy grief, and I'm trying to learn how to love myself. Any suggestions there at all? I have a hard time loving myself. I have a lot of guilt and so forth, but just kind of struggling here. Anything you can suggest would be great. I'm muting now.
Okay, so what I heard the question was that this guy was having trouble loving himself because of guilt. So the first thing I would say is that guilt is not a feeling. It's a thought that has been implanted in you by someone else. And that thought is that what you did was wrong. And that's just a thought. There is no right and there is no wrong. And I would maintain that no one listening to this call has ever done anything wrong. No one has ever sinned, because in every moment they were doing the best they could based upon the knowledge that they had and the circumstances that they were in. So realize that guilt is simply a thought that was put on you by someone else. My guilt comes from my father. I don't know where yours comes from. So that would be the first thing I would do. And then I would So then I would focus my attention on my physical body, and I would feel any pain or any discomfort or any sadness or any visceral thing that was in the body. And as I did that, I would breathe long and slow and deep through my nose and just feel that and try your best, or just don't judge it. Don't want it to be any different than it is. Don't want it to change. Don't want it to go away. Just be willing to live with this feeling for the rest of your life. Because what you have done is you've associated the guilt that you think you've done something wrong with this feeling in your body. So then, because the thought is, I've done something wrong and I have this feeling, then you think the feeling is wrong. There's nothing wrong with the feeling. The feeling is just the feeling. And once you embrace that feeling, and once you are willing to feel that forever, then it vanishes. It goes away. And as long as you resist it and judge it and want it to change, it'll never go away.
You know what I always say? If you feel guilty, you should be ashamed of yourself. But then you're feeling guilty about being ashamed of yourself.
Yeah.
So it gets into such a contradiction that your mind has to just stop for a while.
So I hope that was helpful.
This is pretty serious, heavy business, but I feel that I actually was contributed to my son's death, and I'm feeling guilty and remorseful, and I'm still in heavy pain and mourning. But I feel like that there's always something I could have done. I don't want to take any more time, but thank you for your comment, Richard. It's been great. Thank you very much.
Okay. I would just like to add one thing that just in his language, he says he feels like he did something wrong. He feels he could have done more. Those are all thoughts. They're not really feelings. He thinks he should have done something different. He thinks he caused his son's death. His son died. He did the best he could under the circumstances. If he could go back, it wouldn't be the same. So he would do something different, maybe. But he did what he did based upon that. And it was not wrong. It's the thinking that's causing the guilt. And I really feel for this person, because, my God, what a test of your own mind to have the thought that you contributed to the death of your own flesh and blood, your own son. But I guarantee you that if you open to that pain without judgment, and you go deeply into it without judging that you did something wrong, but just saying, I did this, but it was just what I did, and just feel that, without judgment, it will begin to move.
I killed an adolescent cat that had been hit by a car, and his head could move, and his front legs could move, but I knew that his spine was gone. And so I took, I think it was a shovel or an axe, and basically went over to that cat and just killed it, because I knew he wouldn't live. But I felt awful, and I still feel awful when I think about it. But I know it was the best thing to do, because he would have just been miserable and probably would have died soon anyway. And nobody would have taken him to a vet. You know, it was just... So I feel bad about that, but... Then I decided, well, what do I want to do? This was this morning. What do I want to do? Do I want to think about killing this cat and the look on his face as that shovel was coming down on his head? Or do I want to pet my cat? And I decided, well, I'm going to pet the cat I have and focus on that. And when I do that, I don't think about the other. You can always change the channel. You can always change your focus from focusing on something that feels bad to focusing on something that feels good.
And that has some value. But there will always be something that happens that will remind you of that feeling that feels bad. To solve the problem permanently is to feel the feeling such a way that the label bad no longer applies, that it is just a feeling. And you can embrace that feeling and you can love that feeling. And as you do that, you will love yourself even deeper, because that is a part of who you are. So loving yourself means loving the ugly, bad feelings to such an extent that they lose their label.
It's a technique they use in Scientology. They just call as-ising something.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, being with it with such a quality of your attention and acceptance that it just becomes as it is without any emotional charge whatsoever. And
yeah.
And in the avatar process, they also do the same, because one sprung out of the other. And there's this process where you literally be with the events in your own mind, even if it caused you to ride around, until such time as you hold that thing, you can hold that thing complete, full attention, without any negation of it, without any need to not accept it. And you just completely experience it as it is. And it loses all its charge. It loses its charge at that point. It just becomes an event.
Right.
It just becomes a part of your history without any of the emotional stuff about it. And there's nothing, I've done this so many times, there's nothing more powerful as a way to get to become at peace with something, is to fully, voluntarily experience it, re-experience it, relive it.
Yeah.
I think we've done that subject, huh?
Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful explanation.
So, what else you got, Richard?
What else?
Why don't we just take a couple of questions?
Okay. Give me some questions.
Yeah, what was the name of that movie that was mentioned a minute or two ago?
Chocolate.
Water for Chocolate Substituted. It's a...
Like Water for Chocolate.
Yeah. It's a Spanish movie. It'll have subtitles.
Okay. Thanks.
It's absolutely a wonderful movie. You can't just see it once.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. I'm going to have to try.
Yeah. Good.
Oh, mate, get into it. Find, you just ring a few video stores until you find one that's got one.
Well,
it's a classic.
If nobody has any more questions, I might just talk a little bit more about heart rate variability, which I've been using for about 10 years to help people turn off their adrenal glands or sympathetic nervous system. And I talked to Dennis about how in Ayurveda there's this substance called ojas, which is the finest product of digestion. And ojas resides in the heart, and it gives us life, and that we're born with a certain amount of ojas, and we can add to that or we can burn it up. And things that burn up ojas are whenever the body is stressed and moves into sympathetic dominance. So any drugs stress the body, it burns up ojas. Any anger burns up ojas, burns up our sweetness, because it pushes us into sympathetic dominance, into the adrenaline-driven aspect of our physiology. And when we are in that system, the heart beats in a particular way. And when we're in the parasympathetic or the healing mode of the body, the heart beats at a completely different rhythm. And this has been known, there's tons of research on it. And I recently was doing some research, and I found this program that's made by this Russian guy that analyzes heart rate variability, and within 6 minutes they can determine your risk for getting disease just by listening to the heart with 100% accuracy. And
what's it called?
The machine?
Mm-hmm.
It's actually just a computer program, and it was developed by this Russian scientist, a mathematician, who I call him, I could hardly understand him and talk to him. If anybody's interested, I can email you the website. And
oh, I'd love it, yeah.
Yeah, I can email it to Barry, and Barry could email it around, I guess. But anyway, what was really interesting, that this guy, after he developed this program, he was training, he became a medical doctor after becoming a mathematician and computer scientist, and he was training the equivalent of the Navy SEALs and the Russian forces. And the I don't know if anybody knows about the Navy SEALs, but they're like this elite group of men. And they give them assignments like they'll pull into to do a covert operation in a submarine. The guy will have to swim 4 miles to shore, put together a sniper's gun, hike 25 miles through the forest, kill this guy, come back, get back into the submarine. I mean, and they do this all on their own. I mean, they're just like they're machines. And so they go through this very, very, very rigorous training, and the training is very expensive. And all the guys that come in, they have to take this test, and they select just the very best people. But even those people, only about 1 in 5 would make it through the training. And so they were looking at, well, you know, we have to train all these guys and that don't make it through, it's so expensive. And so they were looking at heart rate variability, and they discovered that they could predict with 100% accuracy these people that would make it through the training just by looking at their heart rate variability. So what does that mean? It means that they didn't have any triggers. Nothing pushed them into sympathetic dominance. And that's what Dennis was talking about. If you can take any experience, physical, mental, emotional, and just be with it and feel it and not run from it, not judge it, then it loses any ability to take you down.
Well, plug you in, as the common expression goes.
Yes.
To the extent we're taken down or plugged in, to the extent that our attention is completely mortgaged, and it drops us into unpreferred emotional states and angst, stress, tension, and unresourcefulness.
And that shows up as a pattern in your physical heart. And it causes the body to break down and to burn ojas, or to burn the life force. And that's what, you know, what we want is we want more consciousness, more hojas, more of this ability to stay in the moment, to be compassionate, to be loving.
So you made the point on the phone call with me the other day, Richard, which I'd like you to recover, and that is that any time we allow ourselves to drop into any kind of emotional toxicity, it anger or frustration or any kind of warlike confrontational energy, this literally steals the ojas.
Right. It burns it up.
Yeah.
It burns it up.
And the benefit is going to be a much higher imperative for those who have understood this, to keep ourselves in a place of equanimity. To literally disallow ourselves from going into toxic states in any way.
Yes, and I would add to that that there's two ways that you can present that equanimity. One way is to suppress and to judge and to shut down any emotion that you're feeling. So if someone makes you angry and you don't express it, then that takes a bigger toll on the body than if you actually express it and let it move through you. Because if you don't express it, it stays there and you keep pushing it down. It takes all that energy to push it down. And that will show up in your heart rate variability. So the person could look totally equanimous on the surface, but actually be totally shut down in their physical body and suppressing feelings using their adrenal glands, tightening up. And this is, of course, what leads to all kinds of diseases, high blood pressure and digestive problems and high cholesterol and all these, the heart disease comes from suppressing emotions. So that process that Dennis talked about whenever you have a feeling, to desensitize it by using your awareness and your breath and your unconditional acceptance of that feeling, so that the energy continues to move through your body. It doesn't get stuck.
Another interesting thing that you talked about on the phone with me, Richard, was, and you may have already covered it in the time when, before I got onto the call because of that daylight saving time issue in the U.S., but I never told me about. you mentioned a couple of your clients would come in with all manner of physical conditions.
Oh, yeah, I told you some.
You were teaching them how to walk and breathe in such a way that condition went away. Would you cover that, please?
Yeah, this was like totally fascinating to me. One time this person came in, had no money, basically, and they told me that they had severe, this woman had severe leg cramps every night, and it kept her awake, and she was getting sicker and sicker and tireder and tireder, and they had gone through a whole battery, spent thousands of dollars of medical tests, testing her blood, testing her muscles, testing her electrical system, and they could find nothing abnormal on that level. And so I just took her pulse and I saw what she was doing, and I found out that she was a teacher, and each day, several times a day, she had to walk from her room to the other end of the school, out to the playground, and to the other end of the playground, and be on playground duty like two or three times a day. And it was a long walk, and I said, okay, here's what you do. And I showed her how to breathe. I showed her the breathing technique. And I said, I want you to walk half as fast as you normally walk when you make that walk, and I want you to use this breathing technique as you walk. Within 3 days, 2 or 3 days, all of her symptoms completely went away. She never had another leg cramp.
Wow.
And it was simply because she was pushing her body a little bit, you know, just every day, jumping up right from her desk at school, running out onto the playground, not paying attention, not loving her body, not listening to her body, and then coming back and then sitting down. It's just completely, and she probably had resentment about having to go out and be on playground duty or something. I don't know. So all of these things contributed, and when she just accepted and loved her body and breathed and went slower and really felt it, everything shifted.
I'm unmuting everybody to make sure that anybody who wants to ask questions can do so. If after you're unmuted you don't want to ask a question, mute yourself.
So, Richie, was there a specific about that particular breathing technique that you had that woman do?
Okay, I will, if you want, I'll do my best to explain it over the phone. It's a little bit difficult, but I'll certainly give it a shot if you want me to.
Go ahead.
Okay, so the breathing technique, and maybe some people have already learned this in a yoga class. A lot of yoga classes teach it. It's called Ujjayi Pranayam, and that's spelled U-J-J-A-Y-I, Ujjayi, and that's the Sanskrit word for it. It means victory breath or invincible breath. And so it's done through the nose. All parasympathetic breathing is through the nose. Any breathing through the mouth stimulates the adrenal gland, stimulates the sympathetic nervous system. So this is done through the nose, and it's long, slow breaths. And what you do is you squeeze the top part of your throat like you were going to swallow the soft palate there, and so that when you breathe in and out, there is a sound created. And I'm going to do that right now, and you can see if you can hear this, and you could just try to imitate it. So I'm going to do it right now.
It's mostly being muted.
Okay, and it's sometimes it's called they call it Darth Vader breathing. It's kind of a throaty, like it's almost for snoring. And you can also, in Hawaii, the Huna tradition, they call it the Ha breath, the which is actually what Hawaii means. Ha means breath. And so it's done with the mouth open, but I think that was just kind of a distortion of the original breath because it was so hard to explain. But they do it like this. They just like you were going to whisper, and they go, ha. And that's the ha breath, the healing breath. But you can make that same sound with your mouth closed, and it's. Okay. Any questions on that?
Can you do it, just exhale it? In other words, Inhale freely, then exhale with the constriction.
Yes. It has a different effect if you do that. It doesn't have as much of a stimulant to the parasympathetic nervous system, but if you're already in parasympathetic dominance, then you can switch to doing it only on the exhale and actually get more oxygen exchange to take place.
I see.
Yeah. So, but it's very kind of tricky. You'll have to experiment it. It wants to feel very comfortable. There doesn't want to be any strain to it. There doesn't want to be any difficulty. It should feel very. It's totally possible to put too much effort into it and actually ruin the effect. So it's a subtle line there between effort and no effort.
Now, do you use this when you're doing certain treatments or certain making certain preparations? Could you describe a little bit of that?
Yes. Any time that you want to focus your attention or you're under physical, mental, or emotional stress, let's say you're triggered by someone does something that just pisses you off, you can use this breath and do it and just put your anger and your frustration into the breath.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a natural thing. Kids do it, you know. They'll go, somebody will do something, they'll go, you know. It's just like grunt. It's kind of a, and it's a way to like diffuse that energy and still let it flow through the body.
Mm-hmm.
Any physical stress, any exercise, any thing like that, a mental stress. Many times we're sitting at a computer and we're not breathing, so it's really good to do this breath then. One thing that people don't know is that our nervous system actually consumes more energy than our skeletal muscle system. And many of the times when we're doing mental work, we're not breathing, so then that activates that sympathetic nervous system, the adrenaline, so you can actually spend a day working at the computer and feel more fatigued at the end of the day than if you were doing physical labor all day.
Wow.
And it's because the body is actually more stressed because of the adrenaline and the lack of breathing.
Sometimes to relax, I'll go do something physical because I sit at the computer all day, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's just a lot more relaxing to get up and, you know, wash the dishes or something, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, especially if you combine that with the Ujjayi breath.
Mm-hmm.
Would make it even more powerful.
Now, do you do some special breathing when you make the oil or are imparting your intention? I'm thinking of something that people might use while they're making ormus.
Absolutely, that would definitely be helpful to
mm-hmm.
breathe this way because it'll help them focus their attention. They could also use mantras, specific healing mantras. There's a Mrityunjaya mantra that is the most healing mantra on the planet, and it's so good for these times. I mean, I usually say at least 108 of those every day, you can find it on the internet. Or I can email it to you. It takes to say it 108 times. It takes about 30 minutes. And it's very, very powerful. And you could say that mantra while you're making the ormus.
Mm-hmm.
Om Triambakam Yajamame. And then that would import that healing energy into the ormus.
Is that the mantra? You said it there?
That's part of it. Shall I say the whole thing?
Yeah.
Om Triambakai Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushdivardhanam Urvarukamiyo Bandhanan Rikchor Mukshiyamam Ritan.
Wow.
That's the mantra, yeah. And it's been used for thousands and thousands of years as a healing mantra.
What's it called?
Mrityunjaya mantra. I'm not sure how to spell that, but it's M-R-I-T. Let's see, I could Google here and find it.
So while you're doing that, I'd like to ask if anyone else has got any further questions for Richard, because we've kind of ignored a lot of the question time.
I had one about Ojas.
Yes.
And what But I remember from when I first started studying yoga was that ojas is depleted if you have sex a lot. Is that something you've heard?
Well, it depends. It depends on how you do sex. I mean, there are Taoist and tantric practices that actually use the sexual energy to build ojas. And in men, that involves learning to not lose semen and when you have sex. So you circulate that energy and you bring it up. It's the kundalini energy, and so it's very, very, it's completely possible to use sexual activity to build ojas. But it takes a tremendous a lot of practice, and it's not something that Westerners are very easily learn because we have so much negative programming around sexuality.
David Hudson talked a bit about his, one of the people that he worked with gave some of the armas, the guy that had he said, spiritual orgasm, regular, constant, and this guy had to actually move away from the city so that he could be more in a more isolated area because there was just too much going on. And several people, not everybody, I mean, just maybe three or four people have reported that when they started taking Ormus, they started having this kundalini energy coming through them all the time, and they said it was like having an orgasm but without ejaculation.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then so that learning to, and the Taoist, like if you want to do some research, I mean, this really gets, I mean, they do some amazing practices that take years and years and years to learn, to develop, and to perfect. But to be able to channel that energy and to use that energy instead of just, to focus it and channel it, and it's very powerful, creative energy.
Any other questions? This is Sandeep from Australia. Yeah, I didn't quite grasp, and actually missed the start of the call. But I didn't totally grasp the connection still with that concept of Oja and Ormus. My understanding is Ormus is certain elements that you bring in from various different foods or you can precipitate it. And my understanding of what you said about the Oja is that it's kind of like a end product of the seven tissues body. Can you just talk a little bit more about the link between the two? And I apologize if it's already been covered.
Well, what my kind of understanding is, and what I've come to understand is that ojas is a product of spiritual consciousness, and it's not a cause of. So that when someone actually precipitates and makes ormus, it's their consciousness and the quality of their consciousness as they're going through the process that actually attracts and manifests the ormus. And that if you could do the same process, and I think some of the people have said how important your attention and your consciousness was in making ormus, but you could do the same steps but without the proper attention, the proper consciousness, and no ormus would precipitate. So, and that's the Ayurvedic understanding, is that consciousness is primary, and that consciousness attracts, expresses, and manifests ormus in many different ways.
In my understanding, it's very similar. The ormus, I like to think of it as a wire. that carries information from spirit to the physical, sort of an intermediate thing. And what we're after is the information or the energy that the wire carries, that spiritual energy, that spiritual information.
But I'm saying that the wire itself is a manifestation of consciousness. And that's what consciousness is primary.
I absolutely agree with that.
I'm with you on that.
And
okay, with the question. Was that close to your question, Cindy?
I think so, yeah. I'll just go meditate on that for a few million years.
Yeah. Well, I hate to disappoint you, but your mind will never understand it. As they say in the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao.
And I happen to know Sandeep is a meditator of a long time. So he'll get it.
Yeah.
And it, along those same lines, the Tao that can be traded is not the correct Tao.
Yeah.
And the other question...
I am going to have to leave because I understood this call to be 2 hours and I scheduled something else.
Okay. Well,
So I need to leave here. If there's anything else, I'd be happy to talk for about another 5 minutes or so. Otherwise,
we should take our last question, a kick from the piano person.
Yeah, we're just not understanding it.
We are not hearing you at all, except for. So, sir, we can't understand your question. Anyone else who'd like to speak up, or who can actually speak in English and not just in tonal language?
Yes.
Okay, well, this is Sandeep. I'm sorry, is there someone else got a question? Because I already just had it.
Go for it.
Go ahead, Sandeep, jump in.
Okay, well, it's just an extension of the picture question, really, which is an observation. So I don't know if it's a question or a statement, but it seems to me that a lot of things that have been shown to raise this object also seem to be through that conscious brain almost as well. So there does seem to be a link in that regard. So for instance, things like coconut and berries, aloe vera, and those sort of things. So there seems to be a link in the two, that by having those foods, perhaps you can build up both elements, the ojas and almost. Is that what you guys understand?
Are they the same thing?
Right.
Okay. But I mean, the other thing in Ayurveda used to be about dairy products, that, you know, dairy products are a really great way of building up oja and ghee particularly. But I've never heard that referred to with regard to performance.
Okay, well, here's, I may have some insight into that. First of all, in the Veda, ghee comes from cows. And we don't have cows anymore, particularly in the West. We have genetically engineered milk-producing machines that have been bred to produce. They're freaks of nature. They, you know, one cow can produce like 10 gallons of milk a day. The kind they're like the milk is not milk. It's not what the Veda refers to. The second thing is that originally, that ghee was made from yogurt cream. That the cream was first made into yogurt, which went through a process of bacteria working on the cream. Then it was made into butter, and then it was made into ghee. And that process along with the intention. Of course, it was done in these sacred kitchens with mantras being said and everything, and so it's a completely different substance than what we have. Completely different.
Yeah, the dairy products are out pretty much.
Well, unless you can, you know, you get them. Find there are cows, you know, the Brahma cows that come from India. I have there's places in America where you can actually get milk from cows and but it is very expensive and very hard to come by. I did find the spelling of that mantra, and it's the Mrityunjaya. It's Mrityunjaya. Mrityunjaya.
No, we can't hear you. You're still sounding like piano. Didn't understand that at all.
It must be frustrating to not be able to be heard, because all we can hear is a sound of trilling tones.
Sounds like an angry piano.
Yeah. So listen, we're out of time for today.
Okay.
And Richard has to go.
Well, thank you very much, Barry and Dennis, for allowing me to speak. And I'll send Barry an email with, what was I going to put on it? Oh, the heart rate thing guy, and along with a link to my website, Ayurveda Plus, if anybody's interested in that. And I guess,
definitely.
Are you going to email it to people?
Oh, yeah, I'll put it on the list, definitely.
Okay.
What you're saying, Richard, is if people actually want to ask you a question, they can go to ayurvedaplus.com. Is that the name of your site?
And they can email me, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they can call me. I have an 800 number.
Thank you for being a service here, buddy.
Yeah.
Whoever's doing the dishes, we'll accept that as your farewell to Richard. Thank you, Richard.
Okay. Bye, Richard. Thank you. Thanks.
It's fascinating. Thank you.
Guys, say who you are and say goodbye.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye. Richard,
bye-bye.
Bye for now. Hope you get to say goodbye now.
Goodbye now.
Fuck you.
Okay, Richard. Client from Western Australia. David in Western Australia.
Hello, goodbye, David.
We're almost hearing you. It's getting a little closer. No, not really. Can't really hear you. I kind of have figured out what the music you're playing is and kind of can hear you, but not really. Didn't understand that at all.
Good night for me. Good day for me. Good morning for me. Ciao. See ya. Bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.